to the History Slam podcast from ActiveHistory.ca. Here's your host, Sean Graham.
Thank you, Adam. Welcome to the History Slam, everybody. I am Sean Graham, coming at you today nearly live from Ottawa, Ontario, where I have just read a phenomenal book, and so we're just going to get right into this interview. I'm not going to do my normal little spiel about something, but so we have the author of Underground Soldier, Marsha Forchuk-Skripik, who is joining us from Brantford, Ontario. Marsha, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much, Sean. It's a pleasure.
So I'm really excited to have you here. I've read the book Underground Soldier. It's really, really phenomenal. But before we actually get into the content of the book a little bit, you have a rather interesting relationship with books and your experiences growing up reading and some of the difficulties you had and how that shaped you as a writer. I was just wondering if you might want to speak to that a little bit.
Sure, Sean. I would like to speak to that. I didn't learn how to read until I was 9. And the reason is because I am dyslexic. It's not something that you grow out of. So I learned how to read differently than most people. And I'm 59 years old, which means that I went to elementary school in the 1960s. And back in the 1960s, you know, the education system was really geared towards only a single way of learning. And it wasn't the way that I learned. And so they had absolutely horrifically horrible, boring books to try and teach kids how to read. And if you learned how to read phonetically, that probably worked. But for someone with dyslexia who does not learn to read phonetically, but sees words as objects, you know, whether they're upside down, backwards, inside out, or whatever, they're still objects. And that's still how I read. It just didn't work. And so I faked it until I was 9 years old, because I had a really good memory. And that's common with a lot of people with dyslexia too, because it's a coping mechanism to hide that you can't read, so you just memorize things. But in grade four, the first time I was in grade four, I got caught on a provincial exam because I wasn't able to get my sister to tell me everything that I had to memorize on it. It was just a surprise exam, so I got zero on it. And then they failed me. So at that point, I decided that I had to teach myself how to read, because I wasn't going to get help in school. It was the same year, actually, that my parents split up, and I was in a Catholic school. And so it was a really difficult time emotionally, because the word divorce wasn't even allowed to be said on school grounds. And my mother went to see my teacher, and the teacher said that I was unteachable because I was the product of a broken home.
Wow.
Yeah. So, and the other thing that was happening, I mean, it was just so rare back then to have divorce, and especially within a Catholic community. We would have people drive past our house in the middle of the night, like drunken men, and throw rotten fruit and vegetables at our house and call my mother a whore, like shout this out the car window as they're driving past. And it was just, I was probably the lowest point in my life. I'm sure it was the lowest point in my mother's life. And so it had a profound effect on me. And part of it was that I realized that I really had to count on myself. And so I just decided that I was going to teach myself how to read. I also wanted to prove it to all those people that had already labeled me a loser that I wasn't. And so I just went to the local public library and avoided all the horrific, condescending picture books that they had in the 60s and took out a novel. And it happened to be Oliver Twist by Charles Dickens, and it took me a year to read it, but I was able to read it slowly, laboriously. It taught me how to read, because like the words were so big in that book that they didn't look like objects. Like finally I had to actually read them. I had to sound them out, decode them like everybody else would have been doing with simpler books. And that's how I learned how to read. And so from grade four, the second time I was in grade four, until I finished grade eight, I read primarily only authors who wrote big fat novels, who happened to be in the Brantford Public Library, and whose names, last names, started with either A, B, C, or D. Because I was going to read them all, right? But by the time I got to all the D's, I figured out other ways of choosing books.
That's really interesting to me, because it seems like at that point, then you're in fourth grade, you can't read, you're having difficulties at home, that would be really easy just to become embittered and to withdraw from everything and say to yourself, well, I'm stupid and I'm not going to ever be good at this, and sort of fall into this trap. I mean, so what was it that made you seek, I don't know if it'd be fair for me to say almost seek refuge in books.
It is actually fair to say that. I mean, I come from a reading family, and my mom would read a book a day. My dad would do the same thing, my sister. And so it was a real frustration for me that I couldn't get refuge in books because mm-hmm. I couldn't read them. So I could pretend to get refuge, but I wasn't reading them.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was that desire to like to fit into, you know, what my family considered very important. I was on the brink of despair to the point that my dad, you know, my parents were divorced, but I had a lot of contact with dad. He actually put me on a crying calendar and he allowed me to cry once a day.
Oh, wow.
That's how bad I was, you know, like, so I was pretty much plunged into despair, but I just figured that I had to do it. But the other thing, too, is that my mom, even when I failed and my report card, I actually bring my report card to school presentations. I've got it blown up the size of a poster. My grade 4 report card, you know, before they had computers and everything was handwritten. And so everything that was circled in red, which was virtually everything, I failed, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I only passed one thing, and it was art, and I got an A in art. And my mother, bless her heart, took that report card and showed it to all the neighbors up and down the street. And she said, look at how brilliant my daughter is. And she was sincere about that.
Wow.
She didn't criticize me at all. She said, you know, I know you're having a really tough time. She said, but hothouse flowers shrivel quickly. And she says, and you're no hothouse flower. When you finally do learn to read, you'll be reading so much better than anyone else.
Was that what prompted you to want to be a writer? Is learning to read on your own and getting to know these authors and sort of using that in your own life to sort of get you out of this funk? Is that what inspired you to want to write?
Yeah. And the other thing was that after I read Oliver Twist, I realized that that was exactly what I wanted to do, was to write that kind of book.
Mm.
And I also realized for the first time why people actually read. And no one had told me this before, but that like people read for the free movies, right?
Mm.
You don't read because it's good for you or, you know, blah, blah, blah. Like all these other reasons that people will give you. You read for the story. You read for the adventure because it does take you to another world. It's the only way that you can plunge yourself into an alternate universe just by holding paper in your hand. So I wanted to be able to do that for other people. But also, even with Oliver Twist, I found myself a very critical reader because I felt that I wanted to do what he did, but I'd leave out all the words that he put in that people skip over because like he had way too much description.
Mm-hmm.
And I found like a lot of the books that I was reading then, because they were these old classics, they were just way too wordy. And so I had a goal all the way back then that I wanted to write books that I wished I could have read when I was a kid. So, you know, I mean, what they were trying to teach me how to read with was, you know, the C Spot Run type books, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's really implied that children are stupid, that children couldn't look at anything more intelligent than that. But then, you know, the other end of the spectrum is things like Charles Dickens' novel that has a good story, but the words themselves act as a barrier. So I wanted to write a fiction that respected a young audience, knew that they were very intelligent, didn't talk down to them, but left out all the extra words.
Generally, you write for a younger audience. So in putting these things together, and as you say, you don't want to talk down to kids, which is really important. But at the same time, we live in a time where kids, from my understanding, seem to be moving away from reading more and more. And you talked about going into schools. How do you try to advertise reading or try to get kids involved in reading and make it fun or make it exciting for them, given the difficulties that we're having getting kids into books?
Well, have you heard of the Forest of Reading in Ontario?
I have not.
Well, that's the answer.
Okay.
The Ontario Library Association has this program, and it's a Reader's Choice Award program called the Forest of Reading. And the Ontario Library Association has huge numbers of volunteers who will go through all the masses of books that are published for children in a given year by Canadian authors. And then they select 8 to 10 books per category. So there's like the Blue Spruce, which is for picture books. So, you know, primary grade kids. The Silver Birch is for kids that are between grades 4 and 6. Mm-hmm. And then there's the red maple for 7 and 8 and the white pine for high school level. These programs, these Reader's Choice programs are so popular that they have 250,000 kids who participate in reading these books, and then they vote themselves for their favorite book. And so last year, Making Bombs for Hitler, which is the companion novel to Underground Soldier, was shortlisted for the Silver Birch Award. So I did not have to do anything to create a buzz for my books, because the reading program itself, kids would read like the selected 8 books, but Making Bombs for Hitler ended up winning the Silver Birch. So like I was just at a library conference last week, and I had teacher librarians coming up to me and telling me that still Making Bombs for Hitler is viral. Like, you know, they'll have 20 copies in their school library and they cannot keep it on the shelves because there's such a buzz about it, and it just keeps on continuing. And that book came out in 2012, and this is still the situation.
Wow. I had, I don't know, obviously not the same programs growing up, but to me, like when I was growing up, teachers would always say, hey, read, it's fun. And it never really hit with me. So it's cool that then if this program's hitting with these kids that they want to go out and read.
Well, the difference here is that it is a Reader's Choice program. So the books are selected for, you know, literary excellence by teacher librarians and librarians. But then it's the kids who choose the winner because they love the book. Right. So they get to read 8 phenomenal books and then they vote themselves. And so there's like the award ceremony that's held at Harborfront in Toronto. Mm-hmm. And they like 8,000 kids will be bussed into this. Uh-huh. So it's the closest that a children's author can feel to being a rock star. Like, yeah. You get on a stage there and the kids are cheering.
Yeah.
And when Making Bombs for Hitler won last year, it was absolutely an astonishing thing, because like I had lineups for people wanting to, you know, to have their books autographed, to the point where some of them were crying because they were afraid that they wouldn't get to me before their buses came.
Oh, wow.
It was just absolutely phenomenal. And so, like, all last year I was doing presentations for Making Bombs for Hitler, and there's been such a buzz among these kids for Underground Soldier coming out, right? Mm-hmm. And so I've already had so much anticipation, you know, emails from kids and teachers and librarians saying, you know, we must have that book. And so also at the Ontario Library Association Super Conference that happened last week at the Convention Centre in Toronto, I was doing some signings. Like, I actually did 4 different signings within the convention. And just to put this in context, some of the booths are giving books away. Mm-hmm. So those lineups are always going to be huge, right? Because you get a free book.
Sure.
For Underground Soldier, I signed at 2 different booths. Both of them, they had to buy the books, and I ran out of the books both times.
Wow.
And this is competing against people who are giving books away.
Right.
So, you know, I think that the key to getting kids to read is to give them something that they want to read.
Mm-hmm.
And to do that is exactly why I didn't read when I was younger, was because the books were just so bad. I mean, that's a value judgment, I know. Like, my older sister, she was an avid reader from the get-go. And she would read, like, this is, we're talking the 50s and the 60s. She was reading things like Nancy Drew, the Hardy Boys, the Bobbsey Twins, and things like that. I could not stand those books. Like, they, to me, they were just, I couldn't imagine, like poke my eye out with a fork. I just couldn't read it. But I think that for me back then, I just thought that they were so banal, you know? Mm-hmm. There was just nothing to them. There is no meat to them. And for me, I want to have meat in a book for what I read, but also when I write, I need to stay passionate about what I'm writing. And so I have to be able to write meaty books or I won't do it. You'll never see like a book about a pink dinosaur written by Marcia Skripik.
Right. At the same time, though, is there not a fear that, and we'll get into this when we talk about the content of this book a little bit, is there not a fear of writing, and this might sound condescending, but writing above a certain level in terms of the content? Like the Second World War, which you write about a lot, is a very complex situation that, you know, it's difficult to understand. So at what point, or is there a point where you're concerned that kids who don't have the background history of what's going on, because I think in before high school, it's only Canadian history that's taught, and so the Second World War is taught in a very specific context, that maybe since they don't have that historical background that you're writing about these things, they might not be able to follow what's going on.
No, I don't find that at all. There's a different way that you write for children versus how you write for adults. If I were writing a World War II novel for an adult, then I would be using the suffering of other people for the titillation of the readership.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just the way that it is, because like adults read for entertainment. And so you take someone that's already been victimized, you know, someone who was taken as a slave laborer by the Nazis or whatever. And then the book focuses around their suffering, but in a way that the reader is entertained. Now, the way that you do it when you're writing for a kid audience is that the kid feels that they have stepped into the shoes of the person who is the victim, and it's not a victim. Like for an adult audience, that person is a victim. For the child audience, that same person is the survivor. Mm-hmm. It's a different perspective altogether. And so what you do is, it's not for entertainment. The child reader is more able to sort through their own problems by stepping into the shoes of someone else who'd had profound problems in their lives and got through it. So it's just an utterly and totally different way of approaching historical events. And personally, I feel that it's more respectful to write these stories for a child audience than it is for an adult audience, because truly, I'm not interested in subjecting people who have already lived through the horrors of World War II, making them into objects of entertainment. It's just not me. I just wouldn't do it. I have way too much respect for them for that. And so when you write it from that way, so the perspective of the main character being not a victim, like, you know, not this passive victim, but someone who is actively surviving, then you also get a lot of adult readers. Because there are a whole lot of adult readers who are kind of turned off by the entertainment buzz of adult fiction as well. Mm-hmm. So they'd rather have a really good, uplifting, meat and potatoes, accurate, historical novel that they know is accurate. And so they'll go to a kid's book instead.
Right. So in talking about that accuracy of these historical novels that you're writing, you are known for doing a lot of research on these books.
Yeah. Yes.
Could you just talk a little bit about your methodology? I know that when I talked to Don Kummer, who was on the show in December or November, whenever we posted it, he mentioned that one of the things that you like to do is oral history, but I know you're also interested in sort of the more traditional historical methods of archives and these other methods. So what exactly is your process when you sit down to do some research?
Well, I am by professional librarian. I have my master's degree in library science. And I didn't get my master's degree to become a librarian, even though I was very briefly a librarian for Agriculture Canada, library like Canadian government. But I got it so that I could be a detective. Mm. I like to think of myself as a writer detective. The topics that I tend to gravitate towards are topics that have not been treated in mainstream fiction at all. They've been completely and utterly ignored. So this means that in order to write them, I have to do a lot of primary digging around. The topics that I tend to gravitate towards are also usually somewhat controversial. So it's important for me to be able to weigh the documentation that I get, because, you know, there's a lot of stuff out there that various groups will put out. And so how do you know whether, you know, this document has more weight than that, or this survivor has more weight than that survivor? Or, you know, are the words that they're using, do they mean the same thing as what I think they mean? So, you know, having the background in library science really helped with that. In addition to my World War II novels, I've also written 5 books of fiction set during and after the Armenian Genocide. And I've actually written more books on the Armenian Genocide, more novels on the Armenian Genocide than anyone in the English-speaking world. And when I began that research, there was nothing. You know, now you've got a critical mass of, fiction set during the Armenian Genocide, but also a lot of memoirs, biographies, government documents, everything. But when I started out, and that was in the late 80s, writing about the Armenian Genocide, it was pretty much impossible, because anything that was written would be destroyed from libraries, right? Like, it was a political thing to make sure that people could not get information on the Armenian Genocide, because it was supposed to not to have happened.
Right.
But to me, when I see something like that, I consider it all the more reason to write the book. And so for these ones, these my World War II books, there's a trilogy. So Underground Soldier is a companion novel to Making Bombs for Hitler, and they're both companion novels for another novel called Stolen Child. Now, because I'm dyslexic, you don't have to read them in any order. See, that's my gift of dyslexia. I don't know up from down or left from right or anything like that, or upside down and mirror image. So all of the books are interconnected, but they can be read in any order without giving too much away about the other one. So if, you know, a kid goes to the library and they only see Underground Soldier, they can start there. That's not a problem. But in any case, before I started writing these novels, I did 10 years of research. Part of the research that I did, the initial research that I did, was to interview people who had lived through World War II. Now, I am ethnically Ukrainian. I was born in Canada. My father was born in Canada. His father came to Canada in 1912. So this isn't my personal experience, but because I had written other Ukrainian books, like my very first book was on a Ukrainian historical topic, I happened to do a lot of presentations to people who were Ukrainian, and I started to hear all these different things, like bits of history that I'd never heard and from a perspective that I'd never heard before. So that's the first thing that you do, is interview as many people as you can about a historical incident and like keep copious notes. But then you, like anything that someone tells you, I never believe anything that someone tells me. I mean, maybe I'm a bad person, but I don't.
I think that that's, you know, when you're interviewing people, there has to be skepticism.
It's their filter.
Yeah.
It's their filter and their truth. Yeah. But it's a starting point. And so then what I do is then I access all the documents that I can about the time that they're talking about in every which way I can. And so, like, one of my favorite things to do is to find PhD and master's dissertations and, you know, like Archives Canada, a lot of these are downloadable from Archives Canada website, right?
Yep.
So then you get those on these topics, and then you look at what their sources were, and then you get those topics, right? So you can get so much stuff, but you keep on building. And then the other thing that you can do is you can get more generalized nonfiction works on that topic. And then once you read those, like, you know, mainstream history of World War II in Ukraine or whatever, right? Mm-hmm. And then you can see what their documents are in their bibliography. And then once you read those, then you go back to the bibliography and access those. Mm-hmm. So it's just digging backwards, right?
Yep.
It's classic standard research. And that's what I do. But what is really hard is to build day-to-day life. And so then I go back to the same people or other people who have lived in that time to be able to fill in what a regular 24-hour day would have been like for that person at a certain year or a certain time. And then, you know, find out what it would be like a year later when everything had changed and take them through a 24-hour day in, you know, various circumstances. I also like to read things from a disparate point of view. So when I was doing my World War II novels, I read a lot of stuff that was from like German soldiers' point of view, Soviet soldiers' point of view. And, you know, you compare the two and oftentimes the dates will be the same. The location will be the same. But the way that they're describing what happened is day and night. Right.
Yeah.
So that's just, it's classic research as far as I'm concerned. But a lot of people who write fiction don't do a whole heck of a lot of research.
Well, then I think the question that a lot of people who would be listening to this show who study history at a professional level would be, you've done all this research, clear and an incredible amount of research for these books, and I don't think anyone would say don't write the fiction, but the question would be, why not write a nonfiction, given that, as you say, some of these things haven't been as well covered in the mainstream literature. I mean, has that ever been a thought to you, to take some of this research and, in addition to the fiction, write a nonfiction work?
I have written nonfiction. In 2011 and 2012, I had two nonfiction, like narrative nonfiction books come out, and they were about a girl who was airlifted from Vietnam at the fall of Saigon. And they're written in novel style, but they're nonfiction. And a book that I'm working on right now is a World War II nonfiction. Mm-hmm. And it's about a family, actually a widowed mother and her three daughters who hid several Jews in Ukraine during World War II. So that's nonfiction. Right. So I do it, but fiction comes to me more naturally.
Okay.
And the other thing, too, is that with fiction, you'll get more readers. You know, a lot of people think fiction is made up, nonfiction is truth, and that's not true. There's a much narrower distance between fiction and nonfiction, because like when I hand in my manuscripts for my fiction books, they're riddled with footnotes. So every single thing that I have, if I put white socks on a character in a certain year at a certain, you know, historical time, I would have to prove that it would be possible for her to be wearing those white socks, because my publisher uses fact checkers and historians to check every single thing that's in the book. And it's not just one reference that I have to have. I don't have white socks because that's trivial. But like any of my historical events, I can't just, you know, come up with them. I have to have them vetted in many different ways and incredible ways, too. So for me, it's really important. Like when people come to my books, I think that they can tell that they're accurately researched. Just by reading them, they know that. And then they look at the back and they read my author's note and they understand, too, how much I know about this topic. One of my pet peeves are people who call themselves historical fiction writers who don't do a lot of research and who may only read other historical novels set during that time and then write their own. And to me, that does a huge disservice to the reader, because readers do they trust writers to do research. But when you're only going to read other novels, then you're perpetuating errors. And in World War II, there are a lot of stereotypes and errors that have been perpetuated ad nauseum. So I don't want to do that. I don't want to make any assumption at all. I want to go to the primary stuff and work from there and not get caught up in this whole thing about whether I've assumed something. And so what it means for me, too, is while I'm writing on a certain era, I cannot read any fiction from that era for that entire amount of time, because I'm afraid that I might unconsciously adopt something that I've read in a book that's fiction and think it's a fact.
Right.
I just have to stay away from it.
Well, then, is it fair to say that what you're doing is nonfiction?
No, because the character is a composite.
Right.
So Luca, in this book, there are many people like him, but there is no specific person called Luca Berukovich.
Hmm.
He's a made-up person.
Okay.
But there are many, many people. I mean, I interviewed Peter Petichny, who was in the underground army when he was a young teenager, and he also read the manuscript for me and corrected things for me. So, you know, it's historically accurate, but it's still fiction.
Right. So let's talk about the book then a little bit. You mentioned that it's a companion piece to Stolen Child and Making Bombs for Hitler.
Yes.
And the basic premise of the book is Luca, the main character, escaping from a Nazi prisoner of war camp. Slave labor camp, sorry.
Slave labor camp, yes.
Yeah. So in this story, in researching this, how did you find information on someone or people who had escaped these camps? Because, I mean, you hear stories, or I've heard stories of people who escape, but the most common scenario is people try to escape and get killed. So what was the process in writing this story and finding the primary research for this particular story?
Well, you know, if you can find a first-person account of someone who did escape, then you've got the core of it right there.
Right.
So it's hard to interview people who then got killed. You know, if they tried to escape and then got killed, they're not around to be interviewed.
Mm-hmm.
So I was able to interview people who had managed to escape. I was also able to access primary documents, you know, journals, memoirs, first-person accounts of people who had been able to escape. And what Luca does is absolutely nuts. And I think part of the reason that he was able to escape was because he really had, like, not a well-thought-out plan, and so no one would really expect him to do the things that he was trying to do.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the first thing he did, and this is a young kid, like he's 12 years old, he hid in a wagon of corpses to get out. Now, that's not what most, you know, young kids would even dream of doing, but because it was so unexpected, he was able to get out.
Mm-hmm.
So that right there. And I mean, for me, it's also a matter of thinking, 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 thinking. about, you know, the landscape that my characters have to deal with and what is possible for them. Mm. And thinking of that, that was something that he could have done. The other thing, too, at the slave labor camps, you know, there were hierarchies of humans. I mean, that's what the Nazis were all about. And so even with the slave laborers, Luca was an Osterbiter, so he had to wear the Ost badge, and that was the lowest of the slave laborers. Obviously, Jews were considered even lower, but they didn't even get to be slave laborers because they were instantly murdered. Mm-hmm. But the ones who were allowed to live, it was the ones who had the Osterbiter badge who were considered the lowest of the low, the lowest of the living. But if you were the next level up and you were able to wear a P for Polish, then on weekends you were actually able to get out of the slave labor camp and work at local farms. And so a lot of those people were able to escape ultimately. Mm-hmm. Because they, you know, were out of the slave labor camp from time to time. The other thing is if there was a bombing of a factory and then people scatter, sometimes people would be able to escape. And remember, too, that not everyone in Germany was in favor of what Hitler was doing. Mm-hmm. Not everyone in Germany was in favor with the war. And so people who were German who witnessed the atrocities happening to other nationalities would often do what they could to alleviate the suffering of, you know, the slave laborers that they encountered. Mm. So, you know, it's possible. It's possible to do this. But what he tried to do is absolutely outrageous.
Mm. And that suffering that you talk about, it comes through really clearly in the book as well. And the suffering and the fear that goes along with what he's doing. And I'm just wondering, how did you find that emotion when, again, most historical accounts tend to avoid the emotional aspect of it and just talk about the process of escaping and what that process was like? How did you manage to find his emotional sensibility and incorporate it into the book?
One of the most important things that can happen to a writer is to have awful things happen to them in their lives, because then it plunges you to your emotional depths so that you can then transform your own emotional depths into your characters. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And so, you know, what happened to me in childhood when I was sitting inside the house and watching people go by, throw rotten fruit and vegetables at the house and calling my mother a whore, that provided me with the emotional depths, mm-hmm. and plunged me down into the depths to understand utter despair. And, you know, what I experienced was just, you know, nothing, you know, absolutely nothing compared to what Luca went through. Mm-hmm. But it did give me the tools to be able to understand a little bit about what he went through and to be able to write about it. I just got an email last week and it just moved me to tears. Because it was from a woman whose mother was an Osterbiter, a slave laborer in Nazi Germany. And she said that, like, and her mother died a couple years ago. And she said she knew that her mother did this. But in all the times that her mother talked about it, her mother had not given her an idea of the emotional toll it took on her. Because, like, survivors will distance themselves from it as a coping mechanism. Mm. And she said it wasn't until she read my book, Making Bombs for Hitler, that she really understood what her mother went through. But see, that's the power of fiction, because if I was only writing it as nonfiction, I couldn't take, you know, what I've experienced and expand on Luca's experiences or Lita's by using my own and giving it to them.
And I guess the other part of that experience is your Ukrainian heritage. Because it comes in pretty clearly in the book as well, as the Ukraine has a somewhat significant role in the book. And I was just wondering how much of your personal background and sort of speaking to your own experience and then I guess your grandfather's experience as well, how much of that is a conscious effort on your part to include that?
Well, I write about Ukrainian topics almost by default. I don't write about them because I'm Ukrainian. I wasn't raised Ukrainian. Like, my dad is Ukrainian, but he didn't want us to speak Ukrainian. He didn't give us Ukrainian names. You'll never find another Ukrainian whose first name is Marsha.
Right, yeah.
Just not Ukrainian. And my sister's name is Cheryl. He wanted us to be away from all that because he felt that it would bring a lot of pain on us. The reason that I write on Ukrainian topics is because no one else is.
Right.
And so it's not because of being Ukrainian. It's almost because I'm not Ukrainian. Hmm. I didn't speak Ukrainian as a kid. I didn't know anything about this. And it's an area that seems to have been brushed under the carpet and no one's really exploring it at all. So I am. Yeah. But I mean, I'm not Vietnamese, and I wrote Last Airlift and One Step at a Time. I'm not Armenian, and I wrote 5 novels set during the Armenian genocide. So I gravitate towards stories of people whose histories have been not observed, have been sidelined. And the reason that I do that is because I feel that, like, you know, it's bad enough for someone to suffer injustice, but if their injustice has been forgotten, it's that much worse.
Right.
And we can't learn as human beings to progress, you know, to be more compassionate individuals if we don't know all the different stories. If we only always hear the same ones over and over again, we don't have a really good context of what history is.
Right.
Now, having said that, my husband is of Ukrainian heritage, too. That's where I got the Skripik from.
Okay,
Korchak is my maiden name. Skripik is my married name. And his father and mother lived through World War II in Ukraine. And his mother in particular told me stories about how they survived that, you know, to this day they give me nightmares. And when I married my husband, his parents would not talk about what they had suffered through in World War II. And the basically what they'd say, you wouldn't understand. Like, people here just don't understand. You've got no context for it.
Mm-hmm.
And they both read Ukrainian fluently, obviously, and they were both, you know, fluent in English. So while my mother-in-law was alive, she would help me a lot with translating various books. And this one time, after she was translating a book for me, and this was for the very first World War II Ukraine novel I wrote, which came out in 2001. And then she said, and like, so the two of them are taking turns, reading a chapter at a time. And I'm sitting in between the two of them with a pencil, pen in hand, and a steno pad, writing as fast as I can. And my whole hand is swelling up because, like, I've been doing this for hours, right? And then after I was doing this for hours, my mother-in-law says, if you have a fresh steno pad, we would like to now tell you our stories.
Oh.
And so they did, and it was just stunning. And when I got home that night and I told my husband what they had told me, he was really hurt because he had never been told their stories, but he was also grateful that they had finally been able to share. But to the point that my in-laws could not go to Ukraine because they'd make a flight or, you know, arrangements to go, and then they would end up having nightmares, waking up in the middle of the night crying, and they just couldn't do it. And so after they were finally able to tell me about their own experiences, they were able to go back and visit Ukraine. They both were able to go to their home villages again.
Wow.
So that's the power of history that's been suppressed. If you're not allowed to tell what you lived through, because no one will believe you because it's not the way that we were taught World War II, then, you know, what a burden it is. And so when, you know, some of my initial books came out and I was doing presentations across the country, frequently I would be invited to a Ukrainian church, Ukrainian church hall, a couple times to a senior's home. And there is this one instance out west where every single person in the audience had either been an Osterbiter or was the child of an Osterbiter, a slave laborer. Every single person in the audience. And yet, had you ever heard the term Osterbiter before? Most people hadn't even.
No, I had not before I read the book, no.
Exactly. So we're talking millions of people, even in Canada, that my books resonate with, and it's been off the radar totally. You mm-hmm. know, what do we hear about World War II? We hear about, you know, Canadian troops. This is what we hear.
Yeah.
You know, we were very fortunate in Canada because we weren't really all that. I mean, yes, we had brave troops, but that's where the war happened in Europe. It was on where now is Ukraine. And during World War II, 10 million Ukrainian civilians were killed.
Mm-hmm.
And then the ones who survived then were subjected to the Soviet Union. And Stalin's ideology about race was very similar to Hitler's in a lot of ways. And he did not have an intention of having, you know, minority groups within the Soviet Union stay alive. And so if you were Ukrainian, you know, you didn't really have a long life expectation. And a lot of those people who lived through both dictators ended up being sent to Siberia.
I find that really interesting, and especially the notion of compassion, which you talked about. I've read something where if people hear that 2,000 people are killed in something, they don't care as much as when there's that sad story of the one person mm-hmm. who gets killed. And whatever that happens in our minds and in our sensibilities that makes that happen. So in writing this book, you mentioned the 10 million people that were killed, and yet the story is told through the eyes of this one kid. And is that part of an effort to find that compassion or to tell the story in a compelling way that people can attach themselves now to this character, and it's a way through which they can now investigate the wider story?
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. You've got it. Yeah. You've nailed it right there, Sean. Because, you know, the 10 million, who cares? It's a big number. Mm-hmm. The one, and you read about what this one kid went through, and it's sort of like, wow, could mm-hmm. I do this? What would I do in these circumstances? And that's really what fiction is all about, is letting the reader step into the shoes of a person in an unusual historical time. I mean, for me, historical. And just figure out what they would do every step of the way, how they would deal with these huge issues. And, you know, there's this other study, I don't know, you probably know about this, but they found that the brain chemistry of people when they read about a certain historical era or a certain thing, reading fiction changes your brain chemistry in the same way as experiencing those incidents.
Mm-hmm.
So people who read fiction become more compassionate individuals.
And those of us who have read mostly nonfiction history tend to get a little more, I don't know what the right, jade is definitely not the right word, but
maybe, I would say clinical.
Okay, yeah. That's a good way to put it. Because we can sit around, and this has happened in my experience at conferences or even around the department, and you throw around numbers of like, 1.5 million people killed, and it doesn't resonate with you.
Mm-hmm.
It just doesn't mean anything anymore.
No, it's almost like a statistic, a fight with statistics. You throw me yours, and I'll lob back another one.
Yeah, and it gets to the point where even though history is a humanity, the human part of it tends to get lost sometimes, I think.
Yes.
And these types of stories can bring it back.
Mm-hmm.
So if we bring it back then to kids and the primary audience of this, or I guess the intended audience of this, is school age kids. When you're writing it and you have this notion of trying to get this out there, and again, this notion of compassion, is there a line with kids that you might cross, or that there's a fear of crossing where it goes from, where some of it might be too much for them? Because there's some stuff in this book where, I don't want to say it's graphic, but it's not easy to read. And I could see how for, an 8-9-year-old kid, it might be upsetting to read. And is that something that you worry about when you're writing?
Well, the difference, again, between adult and kids fiction is that in kids fiction, you don't have the graphic nature.
Uh-huh.
And so in some way, I mean, I have a tendency to write things vividly even when they're not graphic.
Right.
But there's a certain distancing. So when something happens, I'm not right there and I don't describe it, you know, blow by blow. But you feel it because you feel for the characters.
Mm-hmm.
But if I were writing for adults, then, you know, you'd have every single gunshot and you'd have every single stab. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But I don't do that. I don't do that. And that's because I have a kid audience. And also, if you were writing for an adult, you'd probably write from the point of view of the person perpetrating the violence because of the entertainment value. But right. For the kid, because the kid identifies with the person who is having the injustice done to them, it just has that much more impact without being graphic.
And so so for them, it's they understand what's happening.
They understand what's happening and they're able to incorporate it into their own feelings. And so, you know, someone who has read a book like Underground Soldier I think would be better able to resist being a bully on a school ground, because they've been put in the position of knowing, understanding what it must feel like to be bullied. Because, you know, World War II, if you want to get right down to it, is just a story of bullying.
Obviously a different context, though. I mean,
totally different. Yeah. But, you know, you got to look at it in terms of the readership and what their world is made up of and how they're going to filter the story. Right. And that is how they're going to filter the story. In Stolen Child, there's a scene, like, it's about a girl who was taken, captured from her family and taken to Germany for the Lebensborn program, which was when they took young kids that looked Aryan, but they were Polish or Ukrainian, and then they brainwashed them into thinking that they were German. So this girl then is able to come to Canada with an adoptive Ukrainian mother and father, and she goes to school, and she's got a German accent, and so they call her Nazi Nadia, right? And they're making fun of her all the time. Uh-huh. But people who read this book, they understand that, you know, you can't know everything about the person that you're making fun of. Like, you may think that you understand what's going on there, but, like, you know, you read this book, and, like, I've had kids email me about this, like, and say, this really made me understand that I got to watch it when I'm doing stuff like this.
So this idea that sort of the kids understand pain, and so writing and showing that the character feels pain, they understand that. And
they understand pain, but it also gives them an opportunity to understand what intolerance feels like.
Right.
So it's not all about them.
Right.
Because, you know, humans are selfish. And so we have this tendency to always look at everything through our own filter. Hmm. So reading historical fiction like this makes a person step out of their own self, step into someone else, and feel what it feels like from that perspective instead. And that is a huge maturity thing. And it's true for adults, too, because adults are always really thinking only of themselves, too. And so if they can get an injection of empathy by reading from a completely, utterly different point of view that they'd never, ever considered before, then it really does a huge job in terms of having their emotional intelligence grow.
And then I guess the final question that I would ask you is, and I think I asked this of Don, and I asked this of Brian Payton as well. So I'll ask it of you. I know your training, your academic training is for librarian studies or for library studies, but given all the research you do and your methodology, do you consider yourself a historian?
That's a really good question. Probably, yes.
Yeah.
There are aspects of World War II that I've not found anyone that knows it as much about as I do.
Mm-hmm.
And the same thing with the Armenian Genocide. So I've done a lot of pulling together of things and, you know, a lot of aha moments that I've not seen published in other books at all.
Right.
So, really.
Have you had a lot of interaction with the academic historical community?
Yes, and a lot of times they, you know, just think that if you write fiction for children, then you are writing those, you know, pink bunny rabbit stories.
Right, yeah.
But I have, like, within the Armenian historical community and within the Ukrainian historical community, I've got a fair following, too. And so, and also a good collegial relationship. So there are a lot of university professors and other people like that, when they know that I need a certain kind of information, they'll help me with it.
Right.
And I also have a number of people in both communities who will read my manuscripts for me and make sure that I haven't misinterpreted anything from their point of view.
So there's that almost like a peer review type mm-hmm. process.
Yes.
So the new book is Underground Soldier. Where can people find your work, and where can they go buy copies of the book? What's the best way for them to get in touch?
Well, it's published by Scholastic Canada, and that's the biggest publisher in Canada.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you can go to bookstores, or you could go online. So you can go to Chapters or independent bookstores. If you're a student in school, then you can get it from the Scholastic Book Fair or the Flyer. And actually, the Flyers would probably be a really good way of getting them if you're in school, because you could get them real cheap. I'm sure the whole trilogy is on sale right now because Underground Soldier just came out, but they're pretty available.
Yeah, and the other parts of the trilogy, we've already mentioned this, but we'll say it again, Stolen Child and Making Bombs for Hitler puts the trilogy together. And there's a whole bunch of other works. You mentioned the stuff on the Vietnamese girl.
One Step at a Time, Last Airlift, and then all my Armenian novels. I have a website, and it's www.calla.com. And so there are interviews and reviews and all that kind of thing. I just, compile it all up and plop it into my website whenever I get something. So anyone who's interested, it's a good place to visit.
And this book, I loved it. And I
Thank you. It's
one of those things where, to me, I almost judge a lot of times, at least when I'm writing or reading my own stuff, and often when I read other people's stuff, the faster I can read it, mm-hmm. judges how good I think it is, because it's sort of the thing that I don't want to put down. I just want to keep reading it. And this took me less than a day.
Oh, wow. Thank you. Well, it took me longer than a day to write.
Yes.
And the past parts about Bikivnia and Babyn Yar.
Yeah.
That was so difficult for me to write. It was just so difficult for me to write. I was weeping as I was writing those parts. Like, there's parts of this book that, it just took so much out of me emotionally to write.
And yeah, it's an emotional read too, but it's one of those things where once you're into it, I don't think you want to get out of it, or at least I didn't want to get out of it. And so, yeah, so I just sat down and read it and really loved it.
Well, thank you.
So, it really is a great book, and I encourage you, even though it is maybe geared for kids, it's a great work for adults too. And I think everyone listening will really enjoy the book. So I would encourage you, Underground Soldier is a new book. Marsha Forchuk Skripik, thank you so much for doing this.
Thank you, Sean.
All right, and anyone, if you have questions, comments for the podcast, it's historyslam@gmail.com. Twitter is @DrShawneeFever. And if you're out and you see Enrico Palazzo, please say hi for me.
Thanks for listening to the History Slam podcast. Be sure to check out Active History for more features, articles, and be sure to subscribe on iTunes.